The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hearn. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to professional investor and ex-fund manager Jamie Ward. So big welcome, Jamie.
Morning, Paul. Thank you very much.
Did you see that deliberate mistake on the video? Because I got a
small catch live
with Paul Scott. So apologies, everyone, for that sort of like slight mishap. But obviously, we've had a lot of volatility over the past 6 weeks, largely centering on the Middle Eastern crisis. But as we look at sort of equities over the next 6 months, particularly as the sort of like the fog of war is starting to clear and people are getting a slightly better semblance of what the signal is rather than the actual temporary noise. How do you sort of view stocks and shares for the rest of the year?
I think it is a bit of a noise, to be honest. I mean, who knows what summer's going to bring, but it's entirely possible we'll have a different macro factor hitting things. You know, it's not that long ago since we had Anthropic release that Claude legal plugin, and that put the cat amongst the pigeons, shall we say, and you could easily have something like that happening over summer, and it'll be a different thing that people are focusing on all of a sudden. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we got another one, didn't we, actually, last week with Anthropic, with their Claude Myos, I think it was, which sort of like...
It's just a constant stream of new things coming out.
Scaring a lot of people with cybercrime. Yeah. And then just before we sort of start running through some particular stocks, I just want to quickly remind investors of what you look for wonder stocks.
Yeah. So effectively, I'm looking for businesses where the medium to long term looks a lot different to the short term. I'm sort of thinking of it like time horizon arbitrage, because the market tends to price the short term. And often that's fine, because often the short term and the medium term look fairly similar, but there are situations where it looks different. So I don't like to pigeonhole myself as like value or growth or recovery or special situations or whatever. I'm happy to go around different things, but what I'm really looking for is businesses that can be making a lot more money after we've got through a period that, you know, at the minute, like, you know, in the short term.
And what's your hit rate of doing that? I mean, I try and find that all the time, but my hit rate of finding really exceptional stocks, not, what should we say, it's not difficult finding exceptional companies. The hard bit is finding exceptional stocks. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's your sort of hit rate on the latter?
I would like to think it's over 50%.
Oh, wow. Okay. You're a rich man then.
Yeah. Well, no, but I think if you can aim for 50%, I mean, a lot of it's about position sizing and making sure you kind of hold your hands up when you're wrong and pull away from it and just letting things run. I've said in the past that, you know, probably one of the biggest mistakes a lot of investors make is selling too early in things where you've got it right. So really the kind of success doesn't necessarily come from the number you get right. It's making sure you hold on to the ones you do get right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're, I mean, that's very wise words. I still remember the day that I sold Taser shares that turned into Axon International. And I sold them for about, I don't know, $22 or something like that. Last time I saw, they were trading at 500.
I sold Goodwin for about 30 quid in about 2015. And it looked quite clever for 8 years. And then it stopped looking clever.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's move to one of these stocks, sort of wonder stock. We've got Experian, the big cap FTSE 100 credit checker. It's got a bit of an oligopoly, I think, with it's TransUnion, isn't it? And Equifax, they sort of tie it up, etc. But the shares have obviously been hit hard by agentic AI worries that they're going to get disintermediated, or at least some of more their commodity services are going to get sort of nibble that by new entrants. How do you see it anyway?
I've just been writing a lot on this so-called SaaSpocalypse thing where a lot of these businesses like Experian, but all sorts of different things. I got hit really hard when Anthropic had that release in February. And I'm trying to like break out the signal from the noise. And I think one of the things with AI is people can quite clearly see the first round effects, which is usually like, oh, it's going to make coding a lot cheaper. But they're kind of missing the longer term effects. And I think the longer term effects is, you know, there's multifarious and multifaceted, and they can go into all different sectors. But everyone sort of, well, say everyone, the market sort of focused in on this software as a service sector, which I know technically Experian doesn't sit in that, but it is. way I see Experian is they've got a lot of private proprietary data. They spent a lot of money trying to gain insights to sell those insights back to particularly banks, but also, you know, other areas of the economy where understanding what's going on in data is important. Historically, that's meant they've had to pay some very clever people quite a lot of money to do some very clever statistics. I think longer term, they're probably going to have fewer people fewer high-paid people, and they'll be getting richer decision data out of it. And because it's private proprietary data, it's very difficult for third parties to come and train off their data. And that's not to say, as you say, parts of their more commodity end of things aren't going to get hurt. But for someone like Experian, I feel like the bigger risk is regulatory. Like if a government comes along and says, we don't really like your black box approach to doing things, we don't like the fact that you have a monopoly on all this data, and that's the thing that could erode their value. I really don't think it's AI that's going to erode their value. In fact, I think assuming the regulatory backdrop stays the same, a business like Experian probably gets stronger in an AI environment, not weaker.
Yeah. That's
what I'm thinking.
So basically, if I'm a bank, I'm one of their customers, and I'm buying credit to checking data, what you're saying is that rather than buying in vibe code, you know, somebody who's vibe coded a bit of sort of like an app, that then I'll stick with all the credit data, simply because if I make a decision on that credit worthiness of that particular individual and I price it accordingly, I've got a bigger problem coming down the track.
I suspect so. And there's another side of it is as we've got going into AI, it's going to become easier for people with dubious motivations to try and pull the wool over people's eyes, you know, basically like identity fraud and that kind of thing. And a business like Experian becomes even more important in that environment. So there might be opportunities coming from AI, which I don't believe the share price is currently reflecting. That said, I haven't bought it or anything, but it's something that I'm quite keen on paying attention to. I'm sure that, you know, it'll have a couple more hiccups if any more big AI announcements come out along the way. Yeah. But fundamentally, I think the business looks okay over the long term.
No, I would agree. Okay, good. We've actually got a question from Andy22055. He's asking about Pinewood. I don't know whether you've ever had a look at it. Basically, does software as a service, exactly as we've talked about with agentic AI, but for car dealerships. I know Harwood Capital are big into it, and they've got a 30% shareholder Lithia, who are a car dealer in the US, and bought Pendragon in the UK as well. And they're pushing it out, rolling their software, Pinewood software, out across the US. They've got a big sort of like a target of hitting 60 million EBITDA, I think, in 2028. I don't know whether you've any thoughts on this. Well, the shares have been annihilated after receiving a bid at £5 by private equity only in I think it was January or something like that. Yeah, but yeah. They're only just above £2 now.
See, I would hate to give too much detail of what I think, because I don't know it well enough. Am I right in saying they tried to sell themselves rather than be bid for, which was a little odd?
No, I think they basically got an unsolicited bid from, I can't remember, I think it was Bain Capital or Apax, right, or somebody like that in January at £5. It was this spike up at £5.
I don't know it well enough. I have paid attention to it a little bit, but no, I don't know it well enough. I know someone who really likes it, but
I like it as well. Okay, good. We've got Drew is asking about, I think one of you have talked about before, it's the DCC, which I believe is a distributor. It's sort of like, it sold a couple of divisions, healthcare, I think, and now it's concentrated on distributing energy, which is, I think, is like things like fuel oil and liquid petroleum gas, i.e. you know, you go into your cars and stuff like that, and maybe other types of fuel around the UK and Europe and stuff like that. How do you see this one going forward, and whether it's being impacted, I suppose, the question, by the Iranian war with the higher oil prices?
There's a second round effect from higher oil prices, which is lower customer demand. They're not really affected by the price itself, other than how that affects demand, because they're effectively a pass-through. It's a little bit like an advertising agency, how you take a load of cash through your balance sheet, but it goes straight back out the other end, and you only get paid for the service, not the actual. You don't take a turn on the fuel itself. There's a little bit more to it than just fuel distribution. It is trying to build up like a full energy suite of services where it can help businesses and individuals, you know, lower their carbon or whatever it happens to be. So they do things like solar panel installation and maintenance and things like that as well. It's a really well-run business that has been for a long time, but it went through a four-year period from 2018 to 2022, where COVID, A, didn't help, but B, they attempted to enter the US market and couldn't get a deal off the ground, and the market sort of fell out with them. The history of DCC is 14% growth with a 3% dividend yield pretty consistently for about 25 years, which, funny enough, led to a really high rate of shareholder return. And I think that business still exists underneath there, and it's beginning to show again. Historically, that kind of business would trade on a low to mid-teens EV EBIT, and it's trading on a, well, probably a mid-single digit at this point.
Yeah, I think it's less than nine I've got.
Yeah, I think it's well less than nine. Yeah. It's in a really good position, I think.
Yeah.
I think it could be worth £120 a share, and it's 50.
Has it got a good defensive sort of like moat? Because, I mean, it seems quite a commodity type. Just distributing fuel. I mean, it's got to be. I mean, it's pretty low margin, isn't it? It's 4% EBIT margin. So, but as you say, it's just a cost plus type business.
It is essentially a cost plus business. Its moat, if it exists, is just very, very good customer service.
Yeah.
And just running a very lean, very, very well-oiled operation.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, you've raised me one energy company. I'm going to raise you another one here, Jamie. Let's go to Jet 2. Well, it's basically a travel company, but has got a third of its cost in Jet 4. We've got Emma asking for it. The shares have been, not surprising, like all that sector has been annihilated over the last 6 weeks about fear of where they can get Jetfall, never mind pay it, and whether they've got the hedging in place. But how do you see this in terms of noise and signal and potential damage to Jet2 and airlines?
I think the damage, the short-term damage, is probably manageable as long as it remains short-term. If we have a permanent reordering of global order because, I don't know, a big chunk of the Middle East decides to align to China, then that's a slightly different topic. Assuming the past looks something your future looks something like the present with regards to the ability to get hold of fuel and stuff, it's an exceptionally well-run operator that's been around for a very long period of time. It's trading like it's shrinking, but it's actually growing, as in the share price is trading at a level which suggests it's shrinking, but it's actually growing. They're currently going through a what was 12-year fleet improvement plan. They're 3 years into it, so there's 9 years left. Over that period of time, the capacity that they can fly will be about 80% higher in terms of number of seats, not number of planes, but number of seats. And I think they can probably get the flight spots to accommodate that, especially since they've only just taken on Gatwick, which is the largest holiday airport in the country. Once you add it, you get 80% capacity, then you're also going to get a little bit of fare inflation. You're going to sell more ancillary services, whether that's related to the holidays themselves, taxes, in-flight goods and products. And then at the moment, notwithstanding really bad recessions, their profit margins are towards the low end of where they probably should be. I think they're sort of around the 6.5 area. They probably ought to be closer to about 8.5.
Yeah.
So if you're willing to look through what's going on now and assume, or maybe the word is hope, that by 2035, and I'm a long-term investor, so I'm happy to look at 2035, I could be seeing a business that could be generating revenue 150 to 200% higher than it is now on a higher operating margin. And I'm currently can buy that for a PE of 6, where it probably ought to be on 12. And then on top of that, you've got a little bit of a dividend yield. It's not much of a dividend yield, but a little bit of a dividend yield. And occasionally they do a bit of buybacks. And you kind of add it all together, and if you're patient enough, it is one of those businesses that over the next 10 years could potentially 10 bag. I'm not saying it will, but that would be quite an optimistic kind of blue sky scenario. But certainly something like a 400% over the next 10 years would be very, very possible, and that would be very, very attractive, I suspect.
Yeah, there's the 30-year chart. It's actually it's more than 10 bag, didn't it? It was Dart, wasn't it, as a pre-recurrent?
It was Dart, yeah. It only traded 2-5 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Is the fleet old enough and efficient enough in this new sort of like world of higher oil prices? Because that's one area that seems as though they're buying, is it Airbus planes? I think it is. And so consequently, they need to get them more efficient to effectively future-proof the business model. Otherwise, they're never going to get those margins up. And of course, buying planes is never cheap.
No. So the improvement plan that, as I said, unveiled in 2023, the fleet upgrade plan, they said it was going to cost £5.7 billion for about 150 planes. And these are Airbus A321neos. In their biggest passenger capacity, can hold about 220 passengers, whereas an equivalent sort of what's the Boeing they use? 737s, maybe, I can't remember. They're like 160 passengers. So the Airbuses are more efficient and they hold more people, so you can get like the cost per seat down by like 10 quid a passenger. Their old fleet is not super old. And they already have, I want to say, about 30 A321neos out of a total fleet size of about 120. So it's like a quarter of it is already pretty much the best narrow-body passenger plane out there as it is. And every year there's more of the new stuff and less of the old stuff. So I think actually they don't have the youngest fleet, but it's sort of on a par with someone like an EasyJet. Where they look old is if you compare them to Wizz Air, because Wizz Air has got a 100% A321neo fleet,
right?
But Wizz Air is a younger business, so there's an upgrade cycle that you have on older businesses where inevitably you've got legacy assets in there, but they're moving full Airbus A321 over the next 9 years.
Yeah. They may even use the balance sheet to buy Wizz Air, because Wizz Air's got needs to be bought out, and they've got a dodgy balance sheet. And I think Jet2's got a fantastic balance sheet. It's got shed loads of cash to pay for that.
Yeah, I don't think it's got as much cash as it looks like, because they hold a lot of customer cash. But yeah, they do have a very good balance sheet.
Okay, good. We've got Ben Sharman is asking about Focusrite. I don't know whether you own this or you know about it. It's basically high-end audio and professional sort of music equipment. It's had a bit of a bath over late, but the shares are up 8% today. I don't know whether
I've just spotted that. I don't know why they're up.
Any thoughts on this one? Is it now turning the corner?
I think it is. So Focusrite is one of these businesses that everyone loved in 2020 and 2021 because it was a COVID winner. The problem with being a COVID winner is the hangover post-COVID has been horrible, because they had to basically completely change their operations to adjust for a new reality. And then 18 months later, rug pull, everything goes back to normal. And they're left with, and it's not just Focusrite, there are other businesses in this sort of position. Suddenly they're left with too much stock. They're left with operations that are attempting to work in an environment that is disappeared again. And the other thing that happened is it's not just high-end audio. It's kind of enthusiast audio level stuff. And a lot of people who are, you know, hobbyists or whatever, indulged their hobbies in 2020 and 2021. And what that meant is they were effectively buying stuff for the next 3 or 4 years. Because you know what it was like? People were on furlough. People were sat at home. They couldn't go on holiday. They couldn't go to restaurants. And everyone just had money. Seems weird now in 2026 and no one's got any money. But in 2020, everyone had money. So people were just spending a lot of money on their hobbies. So the overhang is twofold. Firstly, you had this operational issue where you had like too much stock. And there's a couple of bits in the US business that were a bit unfortunate. And then the other thing is you had a demand lull, because people had already bought too much. And my thesis on Focusrite is at some point things normalize, i.e. they go back to something like what it looked like in 2019. Now, Focusrite is a more complicated business than a company that it often gets compared to, which is Gear for Music, because Gear for Music is basically just a retailer, whereas Focusrite is a, I won't say manufacturer, but it designs and it gets third parties to manufacture its own products. So it's a bit more operationally complex. And Gear for Music in the last year and a half is suddenly really started turning around. And the reason for that is because the demand's coming back. Now, that doesn't hit Focusrite first, A, because of the stock overhang, and B, because the operational complexity doesn't allow it to show through. Now, I think you're beginning to see it in Focusrite. And they had a trading update in February, and it was really good. And I think the shares were up like 10, 15, they might have even been up 20% at one point on the day. Then Iran hit, and they gave up all of it, plus a load more. And it's like, oh, that's clever. I'm not sure what's going on there. But I have an idea that Focusrite, once you get some time return to normality, which I think will probably happen before the end of the decade, this is a 600 to 800p company.
Yeah.
And it's less than £2.
Yeah. Seems it's interesting, actually, because when you said the recent sell-off, I mean, that's probably just sentiment with the war, isn't it? I mean, it's been the last 6 weeks. It started at basically in February that the term started to go down.
I have a feeling I might know part of the reason, actually, why the shares are up 8% today. Somebody sent me a message last week who knows I've got an interest in Focusrite. Rockwood Strategic.
Yes.
They've just gone through 3% on it, so they're buying it.
Yeah, okay. That's Richard Staveley, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to let you know, he also bought Videndum, I think, and he's in.
Yeah, let's not talk about that one. I don't own that one. He does.
which is, I think, sort of more visual audio type.
It's tangentially related. It's more like
similar sort of thing. Yeah.
It used to be called Vitek.
Vitek. Yeah. Vitek. Yeah. There's just one thing also. I think Games for Music has benefited by it's had a reduction in competition at that retailer level actually. And these guys obviously produce the product that goes in. So it's early in the earlier in this sort of like the supply chain. Okay, good. Let's stay into software. We'll go back to software. We've got something we never talk about, Software Circle, that I know you quite like. This is I think it's basically a blueprint of Constellation Software out in Canada. Has made a fantastic model over 30 years and bought out many software companies on AIM over that period. It's absolutely enormous. It has been hit hard, actually, by agentic AI. We've got Software Circle doing the same sort of thing. How do you see this one? And also, sort of buying and putting a whole bunch of small software companies together. Is there any synergies between? I mean, you know,
what they're doing, attempting to do, yes. They're calling it VMS, which is vertical management software or vertical something software, where essentially they're trying to buy different parts of the same supply chain, of different softwares, you know, along the supply chain. But niche software is really interesting because if you think about how software works, most of the small niche software businesses were founded any time between about 1985 and about 2000. And that tends to mean that their founders are anywhere between about 50 and 75, and they tend to be thinking about retirement. Now, these aren't particularly fast growth businesses or anything like that, but they are kind of mission critical niche businesses that honestly I don't think AI is a big threat to. I don't know Software Circle very well. I've only just started looking at it, and I'm looking at it because I'm looking at a German company called Chapters AG, which is doing the same thing in continental Europe. The thing about Chapters is they've bought 10% of Software Circle. Their COO is on the board at Software Circle, and their COO used to be at Constellation Software. And there's another parallel in here, which is the CFO of Judges is a non-executive director at Software Circle. So they have this fairly clear strategy that they're trying to replicate some combination of Constellation, Judges, Danaher-type business. And, you know, if you look at any of those businesses, whether it's Constellation, Danaher, whatever it happens to be, they've made masses and masses of money over a long period of time. And that's fine. Like, you could go away and buy Constellation Software, and I think that's probably a good idea, actually, for some people. But what would be really nice is if you can find some at the ground level and just hold on to them. And I have a suspicion that Software Circle is kind of ground level buying the next, not necessarily Constellation, but the next long-term Judges type success story. So I'm interested in it. It used to be called Graphenia, by the way, the printing business, but they sold off the printing bits and I've moved into specifically targeting this vertical software industry.
What's the sort of synergies though of putting it together? I mean, you say they've got different parts of the vertical, but you don't tend to get
there's not operational synergies, it's sales and also, synergies.
But what happens is that if you do vertically integrated, you lose some of the customers because you start ending up competing against the customers further down the supply chain. So if I was a software supplier, I mean, just doing, let's say, Pinewood, you know, I do the distribution car dealership software, but if I also did the software for the car, manufacturers, etc., then you sort of like your competitors don't then buy it. It's a strange one when it comes to vertical integration on software, particularly.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure on that side of things. I do know that the way that these businesses are trying to do it, and by these businesses I mean like Software Circle and Chapters, is centralize finance and HR and stuff like that, but basically leave the business units themselves as independent as you can. So there isn't a lot of synergies in terms of in operations really, but there are abilities to attack the same customers if you like. And you might be right about competing against themselves in some areas, but I suspect they've probably got enough going for them that they can overcome that kind of thing.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to a bigger software company. We've got Sage, which is obviously the well-known accounting HR ERP system listed in the UK largely for small, medium-sized enterprises. It serves, its heartland is in the UK, but it sells around the world increasingly now, actually, in the US, competes against QuickBooks, which I think is Intuit, and then Xeros or Zex in Australia.
Xeros,
etc. But then more sort of a bigger up the stack, it's sort of against Microsoft Dynamics and SAP, I guess, and Oracle. Anyway, how do you see this one? It's been annihilated by worries.
Well, that's why I started looking at it again. I think this is one that is probably an AI winner that is perceived to be an AI loser. So again, I haven't bought this yet because I suspect we could easily have two or three more AI announcements in the next couple of years, and it gets hammered again. So I'll do what a fellow guest on here, Richard Crowe, talks about, was wait until something like some sort of bowl or something is forming before I get interested in this. Because at the minute, I wouldn't, and same with Experian, I wouldn't get involved yet. Yeah. But, you know, they had an announcement earlier this year, Sage, because they're integrating AI into what they do.
Yeah.
And they're saying that they are already reducing the number of man hours that a customer has to use their product by between 10 and 15 hours. Mm. Now, bearing in mind, Sage costs the average small or medium enterprise about £400 a year. So if you're saving, let's say, 10 hours at minimum wage, and it isn't going to be 10, it's going to be more like 15, and it's not going to be minimum wage, it's going to be more like 20. But let's just go on the low end. That would be like £110 a week. That's £5,500 a year. They're already saving for a product that costs £400. And the panic about it is, well, what if the customer, you know, whatever it happens to be, a deli or whatever, decides they don't want to use Sage, they're just going to vibe code a replacement for free. It's just not going to happen. I don't see Sage as a software business. I see it as like an essential compliance tool so that businesses can sort of maintain their tax reporting standards and things like that. It's for what it does, it's a very cheap part of a company's expenses, and as they build in AI, it's probably going to become more valuable to the companies. I think it's a good business. I think it's always been a good business, but every now and again people panic about it, don't they?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, if you've got basically you're doing mission critical activities for a large corporate or even just a small corporate, then actually your addressable market now, with the power of being able to spin up your own agents with it for your software, is enormous, because you can just expand that, as I say, the addressable market into other areas. They do ERP, they do HR, they do obviously accounting, but there's no reason why they can't tend to do lots of other stuff and, you know, reduce the back office cost of small, medium-sized companies. I think there's going to be a race, actually, between the likes of Intuit, Xeros, and SAP and Microsoft. They're all going to be thinking, crikey, this is a gold rush for us. Mm. Even though the market, as you say, on this one, and in many fully entrenched software, has got it wrong, because I think they're going to be beneficiaries rather than absolutely hit. But it's been indiscriminate selling.
In the software industry, the big losers are the coders, the actual people working on them. It's not the software companies themselves.
Yeah. Good. Okay, we've got Ben Sharman on a follow-up question. I know you've talked about it highly before. International payments company Wise. I think it was your original Wonder stock. Came out with a very good Q4 trading update, and it seems as though this business is enormous but doesn't slow up. It knocked out a 24-25% like-for-like growth. I mean, where'd you get that with all these crises coming? Where else can you get it? How do you see this one? Is it still really hold your winners, run your winners on this one?
I think so. I really do think that. The total addressable market on this company is absolutely massive.
Yeah.
And they've got such a dominant operations. Like, it's not about it's not a fair competition. You know, TransUnion or someone can't touch them because they can't, even if they could do it as cheap, which they can't because they'd end up losing money. They can't do it as fast. And they're just I don't understand what's going on with the shares. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if these were 50 quid, they wouldn't be expensive. I know that sounds stupid. It might sound stupid, but I think that's true. I just think it's a wonderful business. The Q4 came out this morning, really, really good. They've also announced they're changing to dollar reporting, but that's because we mentioned before they're moving to a dual list in the US. And I think they've set a date of May the 11th now for their NASDAQ listing. And I've said before, and I'll say it again, I think US tech investors and growth investors really understand growth better than the UK. And that's probably because we don't really have very much things like this. I mean, there's not many businesses that grow at the kind of levels that Wise is able to do. Mm. So we don't tend to know how to price them very well, but they do in the US.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of sort of stable coins, if there was ever, you know, basically a government, a Bank of England, or basically the EU. I know EU have been sort of intimating. Then obviously you've got Trump out in the States who's thinking about doing a, you know, sort of like a Federal Reserve-backed stable coin. If you get those, would that impact at all sort of like cross-border transactions? Because in theory, it should take the friction cost down to zero.
It takes single currency friction cost down to zero.
Yes.
So your dollar to dollar is fine, because you're basically removing the banking system. That's the whole point of having a stable coin.
Yes.
Obviously, you still got the on-ramping and off-ramping thing, but assuming in the world in the distant future where we don't even have that,
then
if I wanted to transfer money to you, it would be seamless. It'd be like sending an email. I'm not sure how it's going to work because I don't think anyone's necessarily done the work on it. But if you're in US dollars and you want to buy Brazilian real, even if they're both stable coin, there still needs to be an exchange rate. There still needs to be some sort of mechanism.
Yeah.
Now, I assume that in that scenario, Wise's competitive advantage does diminish quite a bit because these fantastic payment rails they've created are suddenly not old fashioned, but they're not necessarily that useful anymore. What I would say about the stablecoin thing is, you need to go into a situation where there is no on-ramping and off-ramping, but B, you also need lots of countries to do that. So you need a Brazilian stablecoin, you need a European stablecoin, you need a British one, a Japanese one. And that only at that point is it possible to very, very quickly and very, very easily have like an agreed exchange rate and you can just transfer from one to the other. But we are a long way off that.
You're not far, mate. Apparently, Ecuador has already got it.
Why are they using Bitcoin? I don't think that's a stable coin.
Okay, let's move to house builders and construction. We've got a real Marmite stock that Kate's asking about, Vistory. I don't know whether you've had a look at this one, but it used to be, it basically was headed up and sort of championed by rock star house builder Greg Fitzgerald, who I believe after this morning has just decided to make a hasty retreat and immediately step down, albeit I think he's indicated they put a new CEO internal appointment into it. The shares are down actually 5%, having got absolutely annihilated about all kinds of worries about liquidity and contracts. This is either the cheapest stock in the world in the FTSE or the FTSE 350 or of total value trap. How do you see it?
I'm on the cheap end. I think it's one of the cheapest stocks in the FTSE 350. I think it might be the cheapest stock in the FTSE 350. It is a Marmite stock. I know people are going to disagree. I've got a very good friend who's a very sophisticated investor and he's shorted it down there. But he still dislikes it, but he dislikes Greg, like from a personal point of view, to be honest. So Greg announced his retirement. They had a trading update. Should I give some backstory? I suppose I ought to give some
backstory. Yeah, please do.
2023, they announced they're going to do a strategy shift. they're going to move over the medium term, whatever that meant, from a pure normal house builder, buy land, build houses, sell them, to a partnership one, which is where you go to a local government or whatever, and you agree to build a housing estate on their behalf. Different model completely. And in doing so, it would free up an awful lot of capital, and it would change the dynamics of the business, make it more predictable and higher return on capital. Now, in the intervening time, we've had a few hiccups, some of them self-inflicted, some of them market-related. So self-inflicted, in the old house building division, in the Southwest division, they had a bit of a nightmare where whoever was running that local division, and I suspect they were sacked, had made a mistake in the accounting, should we say. I think it was related to working capital. And it looked like there was a shortfall of like 150 or 165 million quid, which just seemed absolutely enormous. Now, I believe they've tidied all that up now. I think that's in the past. But that didn't help sentiment at all. That was why it went from like 13 quid to 6. Since then, you've got to have this transition from normal house builder to full partnership. Now, that frees up a lot of capital. But if we were in a really good housing market, they could just sell their houses as they come onto the market, free up the capital, give some of it back to shareholders and some of it into the partnership business. But what's actually happened, as you know, from the other house builders, is it's been a horrendous housing market. So they've sort of had to turbocharge getting out of the normal house building business by selling bulk houses on discount to, you know, investors or whoever it happens to be.
This is specifically in the South Division, actually, because that's where it's more expensive. I know the London market has been just static, hasn't it? It's frozen out because it's so expensive.
Completely frozen, yeah. Yeah, I've heard from estate agents in London that it's just absolutely dead. But, yeah, so that's been very difficult for them. There's been a bit of a... sorry, and then Greg announced his retirement in, I think it was end of February. Now, if you listen to the analyst call, and I think one of the most salient points in that is he said, look, I'm rich, I'm working very hard. And then he said, and my wife's a bit older than me. So I thought, well, that's an interesting snippet. So I'm going to look into that. And I worked out that his wife is actually 14 years older than him. And I thought, well, you know, once you start getting up towards that age, you really start thinking about how much quality time you're spending with people. And so I feel like it's very legitimate that he's decided to retire slightly earlier than people were expecting. He's 61, his wife's 75. That makes perfect sense to me, you know? The guy that they brought in, they've internally promoted, I'd heard from a hedge fund manager who owns Vistry that he's met this guy, and he said that they more or less knew that he was going to be the next person anyway. His name's Adam...
Daniels,
thank you. I've not met him, but I've heard he's very impressive and he really understands the partnership thing. And the partnership thing is more about client relations, because you're dealing with a lot of big housing investors.
Yep.
There's one misunderstanding I think a few people have had about Vistry, which is they announced when they were changing the partnerships that they're going to return £1 billion of capital to shareholders. And I think some people think they did that, but the idea was they would give back £1 billion as the house building side was drawn down. They've actually only given back about 250 million, which is just as well, because they appear on face value to have quite a strong balance sheet, but it's not as strong as it looks. So they reported like 150 million quid-ish net debt but at the year end, but their average net debt through the year is like 750, and their headroom is like 1.1 billion. So its balance sheet is not nearly as strong as it looks. Having said all of that, I still think they are progressing towards what they said they were going to progress to, which is eliminating the house building business probably before the end of 2028. And then what's left will be a much higher return on capital partnership business. I'm slightly skeptical whether they'll hit that 40% return on capital target that I've talked about. So, but if they hit, say, 30%, they'll probably still be making like 600 million a year in EBIT. I mean, what's the enterprise value? Even if you use the average net debt, I think the enterprise value is going to be like 1.7.
Yeah, I've got it even less than that. I think it's I've got it 1.1 at the moment.
No, that's year end net debt. I was like, even if you use the slightly more negative average year net debt figure rather than the year.
Oh, I see. Yes, yes, it would be. Yeah, yeah.
Too. Yeah, even using that, even using a low end figure, what I think EBIT's going to be in the next couple of years, and a high end level of debt, it still looks like it's on 3x.
Yeah.
So I'm at the cheap end.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot here, Jamie. Right. Mm-hmm. The Times, as you know, reported they're having problems paying their suppliers, and the liquidity is tight, and it chimes with why they had to basically dump a shed load of good houses on the market with really low, with really high discounts, sort of like, you know, lower margins at the end of last year and at the start of this year. It just sniffs of they haven't got enough cash for their day to day, which seems now to be priced into the market. So I'm putting you on the spot. Is this noise or is this signal?
I think it's noise that could have turned into signal had they not dumped those houses. I think they were a bit closer to the wire than we probably hope, but I don't think they are now. I saw LinkedIn post from the CEO of one of those suppliers, and it basically read like a farmer that has to deal with Tesco. It's not, I don't think it was anything as bad as people think it is. And I suspect that supplier has probably just signed like an 8-year contract with Persimmon or something. It's like, well, we can burn that bridge. Yeah, so they did. I don't think it's as serious now as it appeared to be when it came out. And I don't think it was as serious then as people thought it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
Also, Greg, by the way, since he's announced his retirement, he bought £900,000 worth of shares at £4 a share.
Yeah.
And they're £320 today.
Yeah. Memory's a rich man.
He knows what's going on in that.
He's a rich man.
He's a rich guy, but that's still £900,000.
Okay, no, fantastic detail on that one. Let's go a bit further down the... industry. Let's go to building products. We've got Brian asking about Alumask, which basically do niche sort of building products for things like roofs and rainwater, and they sell these big stormwater drains out to airports out into the States, Hong Kong and Singapore. Really good margins, actually. Not surprisingly, like everyone else, has been hit hard by the slowdown from the budget last year.
Yeah.
And now, obviously, the war in Ukraine hasn't... In fact, I think it's got... Even what Speedy Hire said has even got worse in the last quarter. But how do you see this one? The shares have fallen a lot for a high-quality business.
Yeah, well, this is it, high quality. So there's a whole swathe of construction-related businesses out there that have got absolutely hammered. And if you get a construction recovery, they'll probably all just motor higher. And I'm sure we will get a construction recovery at some point. You know, this too shall pass. But what interested me about Alumask is, as you say, it's a really quite good business. It's a lot better than a Speedy Hire or something like that. So it feels to me like a much safer way of playing a construction recovery if you wanted to do so. I mean, I just think it's a good business. I just think it's I think it's a good business in a sector that has got absolutely hammered. So if you were interested in that kind of trade, then Alumask is a really interesting way of playing it, I suspect.
Yeah. Do you know anything about the new CEO? Because it was run by Paul Hooper, who's just retired at the end of March. Penny, I think her name is.
Penny something. I don't know much about her, no. Yeah, and that's one thing you're going to have to watch, is make sure she's following along the same path. But I think she does. And I know someone in the industry who might have an insight.
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah, that'd be useful. Okay, let's move to internet sort of like a portal. We've got Auto Trader. Roy's asking about it. These guys are probably the number one website, internet real estate in the UK for selling second-hand cars and buying second-hand cars. And they get their clients are obviously individuals, but also dealers who want to sell it as well. The shares, given everything to do with agentic AI, have been annihilated or they've come down a lot. Is this again a value play or a value trap?
I think it's a value trap. I think there's a value play in the short term and a value trap in the long term. And I think AI is actually a problem for them, a bigger problem than it is for, say, some of the software businesses. I did write about them quite recently for Money Week. I wrote an article, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to swear now, on enshittification. And this was an example I used, which was a business that is basically abusing its customers, being car dealers. But I was speaking to someone recently who said that's not really how you need to look at them. The end customer of cars are people who buy cars, not people who sell cars. And like, you know, you go back historically and let's face it, used car dealers haven't had a very good reputation. So perhaps it's quite good that they're kind of holding their feet to the fire a bit. So the bull case on Auto Trader is like, they're effectively using the capital of the balance sheet of their customers to sell cars, because they basically capture some of the economic value of the sale without having to put the capital up. And that's really attractive. And the car dealers themselves, they're not very happy, but who cares? The world's changing. I think long-term, my concern with these is, you know, I've been following the AI story quite closely. And, you know, we've been talking about autonomous cars for a while now, and we are beginning to see bits of it. I mean, Waymo is now trialing autonomous taxis in London. So it's even getting to the UK now. I do wonder whether we are closer than people realize to automated transport. And at that point, why bother owning a car?
Mm.
I wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a longer term risk, but I'm with you. It's sort of like, you know, if you're an individual and you're looking to buy a car at the moment, yes, you would pay a second-hand one. You would go on to something, may go on to Auto Trader, or you may just do a generic search and it picks up from the dealerships like, you know, Bristol Street Motors and people like that down the road. But going forward, if you do have your own agent on your smartphone, i.e., you know, ChatGPT, and you can trust it, you just give it an instruction, just go away and find it, and then it can find it from any place. It hasn't got to go to Auto Trader, and no. And if you're a seller of a car, then you haven't got to pay Auto Trader. It just comes straight through. So I think it's I would agree. I think it's going to struggle to grow, actually. I think these long-term secular headwinds there.
Well, they charge $4,000 a dealer per month.
Okay.
Per month.
Okay, well, in that same vein, then let's talk about Rightmove. What's your sort of views on Rightmove? Because that's even worse. It's got basically, it's a portal for all things property in the UK, and it's got this actual legal lawsuit now.
£1 billion.
Yeah, all the estate agents, or not all of them, a lot of them have got together basically saying this is a monopoly and it's a predatory pricing, which has been around for some time. And how do you see this one going forward? Because it seems to be one of the last bastions of the portals with huge barriers to entry, with economies of scale, massive margins. But again, we've got this long-term secular potential disintermediation from agentic AI.
Again, I it's a little bit like the Auto Trader story for me. I think, I mean, their margins take the mickey. They make far too much money. And like, if you want to show that you are a monopoly, make a lot of money. Do you know what I mean? And they're just begging to be regulated. They're absolutely begging to be regulated. Even if this lawsuit doesn't come through to anything, they're not the worst portal type business. The worst one, I think, is Trainline. But you know, they've got this. You know, you can argue they've got this great economic moat, and people are more or less forced to use them. But you know, we've got hopeless government in this country. But I would be looking at Rightmove, and that would get regulated.
Yeah.
It should be a regulated utility.
Yeah, you don't get many businesses with 66% EBIT margins, do you?
No. it's a funny thing for a capitalist to say. Well, actually, it's not a funny thing for a capitalist to say, if you're not a capitalist, really is, but they make too much money.
Okay. All right, well, let's switch sectors. Let's go into the sort of like the consumer side. Let's go to Churchill, China. Adam's asking about the crockery maker for pubs and restaurants. I think they came out with a trading update today. Seemed to be in line. Tough, though, obviously, competing against the Chinese and the Asian manufacturers. But they do have a good brand. I think they make all their stuff out in Staffordshire, I think, Stokeway still.
Yeah. I've been to their factory.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, well, putting all that together, how do you see this one going forward?
Going back to Richard Crow thing, I would only be interested if it started looking like it was going in the right direction. I mean, it's clearly extremely cheap. Like a third of the valuation is cash. I suspect you could probably close a factory and sell everything off, and you'd end up with quite a bit bigger number than the market cap. It's just got hit by a confluence of so many bad things. So you've had the AIM thing. So, I mean, years ago, I used to run IHT portfolios, and Churchill China would always be one of the favorites because it was a kind of dependable, real, proper business. So, pretty much everyone with an IHT portfolio would have had Churchill China. that's all, not all gone, but mostly gone now. So you've had this withdrawal of capital. Then you've had the side where, because passive investing is continually on the rise and there's fewer and fewer small cap active investors, and what they are running is less and less, no one's looking at this anymore. So it's just going down and down and down. And then on top of it, as you say, it sells into the hospitality sector, and that's not been fun. Mm-hmm. And it's really not been fun at all. I mean, look at that. Has that gone from 20 quid to three? Wow.
Yeah, it has, yeah. In 5 years. It's just in terms of not being understood and known, does it actually put out any broker notes? I was just looking at, I was just looking on SharePad, and I'm not getting any estimates at all.
I don't know. I don't. Maybe they don't.
I don't think they do.
It's the Roper family that started it and still own a bit of it, and I think there's some Ropers working there. But right. I suspect you could take this private. Yeah. And so take it apart. I mean, it's not a very nice thing to do. I wouldn't advocate it, but it's one of those companies that's probably worth quite a lot more dead than it is alive.
Yeah.
The problem is just so few active investors out there. Unless someone like Rockwood comes along and really starts banging the drum for it,
yeah,
I just don't see why it's gonna stop being cheap.
Yeah, no,
bad, really.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's again switch sectors. Go to advertising and all things sort of marketing approaches. Go to Brave Bison. Charles is asking about it. These ones are really seem to be, you know, the bit between their teeth, run by two brothers, Theo and Ollie Green, who have been doing a buy and build strategy. Given in the sector, it's been a sort of pick your dead man walking. This one has really performed well so far for investors. Yeah. They bought about, I think, 12 months ago, Mini MBA from Central Media. And they've just picked up a position, I think, in System One, which does marketing and advertising prediction. How do you see this one? It's quite an interesting play, this one.
Yeah, it's a kind of whites of their eyes type thing. So I've met those brothers a couple of times, and I think they're really shrewd operators. It partly helps that they've learnt at the feet of their father, who was a seriously shrewd operator himself. As you say, they're buy and build in the media sector. The System One thing is case in point, like an example of how shrewd they are. They have bought a few shares in the market, but what they've actually done is they did a share swap with the founder of System One. So they took a load of his personal shares in System One, and he got Brave Bison shares in return, which basically created this low cash usage cross shareholding. And at the same time, for Brave Bison, added another partnership within there. They have this demonstration where they talk about having this upside down cone in media, where you have like all the different levels before you get to the actual advertising and the kind of performance measurement at the bottom. And they're trying to fill all of the cone, and things like the System One deal just allows them to kind of fill in all the different bits that they need to do. The thing with the sector they're in, it's full of people running lifestyle businesses. If you imagine your typical media person, they wear stupid glasses. They work in like...
No stereotype here.
It's true. I've met some. They work in Soho or somewhere like that. They like quite expensive lunches. They win a few decent contracts and they live off the contracts. And that's all they do. They don't run them as proper businesses. Whereas these guys are different. They're like, no, we have a cheap office. They're not in Soho. They're not that far from there. I can't remember exactly where they are, but I think they're just off Warren Street. And they put in proper operations. They've got a really good CFO, Philippa something. Like that. If you read the accounts of Brave Bison, they are so clear. And I think that's down to their really good CFO. They don't pay themselves very much, or depends how you look at it. They either don't pay themselves very much or they pay themselves masses. But it's all performance fee. And it's proper performance fee, because it's if the shares go up, we make money, not if we hit a specific metric, we make money. But the actual salary they pay themselves, it's like 120 grand a year, which fine. They're guys in their 30s. To the average person, you say getting 120 grand a year, that sounds like a lot of money. But for a listed company, having no cash bonuses or anything like that, 120 grand a year is sod all. So I like the guys doing that. I think they're doing good things there.
Yeah, I've spoken to them with Paul Scott, actually, and they're hungry as hell. I mean, I think it's not the monetary. It's basically the...
Proving themselves.
They want to achieve, basically.
Well, my dad's worth over 100 million. I don't think they're necessarily doing it for the money.
He's been following your wonder stocks, hasn't he? Okay, right. Let's go to something we never talk about, which is fantastic. Workforce management software platform, Crimson Tide. These guys have had, over the years, numerous approaches from people like Checkit and I think from another party, who Checkit actually, I think, are similar, and they've put themselves up for sale. But anyway, Crimson Tide help sort of companies do sort of like lists to automatic lists to make sure that they industrialize processes, things like cleaning, meeting regulatory healthcare standards, catering, toilets, and all this sort of stuff. So to automate this whole process, how do you see this one? Because obviously there is a concern over disintermediation from agentic AI on this
So this is one of those rare things that I own but don't have it as a wonder stock, even though I think it's got very high return potential. And the reason for that is it's just too sodding small. Like if I go out and tell people you should buy this, they won't be able to get back out of it again. Yeah. And I'll probably end up moving the share price, and it just feels a bit icky doing that.
Yeah.
But I came aware of this last year. The same good friend of mine who absolutely hates Vistory had become aware of this because he knows the new chairman. And historically, Crimson Tide, I don't want to insult the people running it too much, but it funny enough, similar parallels to with Brave Bison's industry, it seemed to be run as a lifestyle business. Mm. And the clearest example I can give of that, if you look 3 years ago when it had the old board, it was a $6 million a year revenue business, and the board was costing £1 million. That's just mental. Like, you could, not £1 million, about 800 grand, sorry. It was about, 12, 13% of the revenue was just going on paying the board. So when you had the new chairman come in, his name's Chris something, I can't remember his surname. The entire board was removed, and it's all completely being replaced. And it's being replaced with young, hungry people on a lot less money. So the board, just the board cost on its own got halved. So when you're talking about the board costing 13%, halving it, you're already adding like 6 or 7 percentage points to your margin. And they're being incentivized for growth and for tidying up the operations, neither of which had been particularly well done in the past. Partly, though, that was because they were defending against, as you say, people like Checkit making speculative approaches for them. The long and short of it all is I think it is a business underneath here that can grow, can generate a real profit, and is priced like it's dead. And I understand why, because it's been around for a long time and it's never really delivered. The way I'm looking at it, though, is that I think it had about a 3.6 million market cap when I bought my shares. It's currently 5.4, but I bought them in my mind thinking that if it can create proper amounts of profitability and it does get the revenue a bit higher, this is the kind of business that would be on EV sales of like 3 or 4 times.
Mm.
And let's say sales at that point are £7 million and it's 3 times. That gets you to a £21 million market cap. So it seemed a bit speculative, and it's a bit more of a feel type thing. But at 3.6 million quid market cap, I just thought I'm going to give that a go. And what I've seen since, I've been impressed by it. So they've had a trading update. I think it was just before Christmas. It might have been just afterwards. The only thing they need to tighten up a bit is actually their shareholder comms. They released a puff piece announcement, which was basically announcing they'd won 3 new contracts. But they released it on the Thursday before Good Friday. It's like, what's the point? No one's going to read it. And no one did read it. You look on Twitter or anything like that, you can't find any record of it. But, it was a good little announcement. It's just things like that. And I think they're going to have they've just moved to a April year end. So they're in a 16-month year at the moment, which I suspect means we're going to have a trading update at the end of this month. And I just have a sneaking suspicion that it's going to look a lot better than people realize.
Yeah.
Certainly a lot better than a company that's only got a 5.4 million market cap, should be.
Yeah. If I was a customer, that would just put a devil's advocate here. If I was a Sainsbury's or, a company that needs to clean things or whatever it is, and I need to basically make sure that things happen just for health and safety or food safety or whatever it is, then I could spin this stuff up. I can spin up a checklist, essentially,
of what people need to do and automate it pretty damn easy. I mean, I could do it now, never mind having to vibe code it. I just wonder, because you've got a large customer, then you've got economies of scale by doing it yourself. I mean, I know it's easier, but they probably only charge, I don't know, 20 grand a year to do the whole lot. That's a big pivot.
They don't charge a lot.
Yeah.
And that is basically it. They don't charge a lot. Like you said, I think it's a lot easier to vibe code a replacement for what they do than it would be for something like Sage. But
yeah.
You know, Sage is I don't know, what's the market cap on Sage? 7.5 billion. This is 5.5 million quid. It's, there's different scales to this. They did lose one contract. They had five big ones and loads of small ones, and they managed to renew four of the five. But the one they didn't, I don't think they were that bothered about anyway, because it was Morrison's.
Yeah.
And they had a bunch of custom functionality that they needed in there. Which meant that it ended up being a lower margin, a high revenue, but low margin contract because it was just a bit difficult. So I think they were quite happy to walk away from that one, to be honest.
Yeah. I think it puts a limit on pricing for this opera because you're priced against vibe coding. A big corporate doing it. So you have to have a really large one-to-many model. Okay, let's move sectors. Let's go to my retail favourite, as you can see, Sports Direct. Let's go to... It's kind of Mike Ashley and Fraser's. How's this business doing?
I love this business. It's so good. The distribution is the big thing that I think that a lot of people have missed, which is they've got this robotic distribution systems now, which they built in the aftermath of the Shirebrook scandal. And it allows them to kind of, for one thing, it knocked 100 million quid off their working capital because it made them much more efficient, but also reduces the costs and things like that. But the main thing about Frasers is they're very opportunistic at buying very cheap assets. Even if they're not running them forever, they tend to compound the book value. But the problem with Frasers is I'm fairly certain it's going to go private soon, because Mike Ashley had 60% of the equity at list, and he had 60% of the equity for quite a long time. And then they started buying back shares, but not buying back his. So now he owns like 73.6 or something. A few months ago, he borrowed, I think from HSBC, he put some Fraser shares up as collateral and borrowed a load of money, which was equivalent to 23% of the market cap. When you consider he used to own Newcastle, he sold that for 300 million quid a few years ago. So he's clearly got a bit of cash behind him still. He has enough money to take the entire business now. Like, I can't think of any reason why he would borrow 23% of the market cap other than to take it private. And for people who aren't aware, I'm sure most of the people watching this are, but at 75%, you can basically pull a special resolution where you can take it private. I'm not sure if it's at the prevailing price or like the average price over the last 12 months or something like that, but you don't have to bid up the shares.
Yeah.
So he just has to get over that 75%, which he could do tomorrow if he really wanted. And then he could take it private. And I think it'd be a real shame, because I think this business, like, given a fair wind, is, you know, it's worth a multiple of the current share price. But
okay, I'm gonna put you on the spot again here, Jamie. If you're right and he takes it private, or he's basically monetizing some of his shares and giving it to somebody else to take it private, if you're correct, what will be the takeout price?
It'll be probably 7 quid.
Yeah, exactly.
It won't be much.
No, I know.
That's the sad thing about it. Like, I don't want it to go private, but if it does, I'll make a little bit.
Yeah, but I know.
Put it somewhere else. You know, it's a heads I make a lot over the next few years, tails I make a little bit in a short period of time.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool.
End of the world.
Okay. No. And then let's go to spirits and all things sort of Guinness, etc. We go to Diageo. Gordon's asking about it. Now, I know this one is a real sort of, again, another Marmite stock. It used to be a darling. In fact, if I remember about 10 years ago, Warren Buffett used to love it, and then obviously it had another boom during lockdown because everybody hit the sofa and with a bottle of scotch and Johnny Walker and stuff like that. And now it's still doing well on Guinness. Guinness has done very well, but it does seem as though some of its shine off the priciness of its products and its brands has been taken off in America and in China. How do you see this one? Because it's got now a new rock star CEO, Deadly Dave from
Dave Lewis.
That's it, yeah, Dave Lewis from Unilever and from Tesco fame.
Yeah, I mean, if you're betting on him, you're betting on him having three lightning strikes, because he's done two good things. He needs to do a third good thing now.
Yeah.
My thing with Diageo, I think at some point, and again, I'm going to go back to Richard Crowe's idea, if it starts looking like it's going the right direction, it might be a trading buy. But for God's sake, don't think it's going to go back to 40 quid, because I don't think that business exists anymore. You've got quite a few things that are going against it these days that are probably long-term structural. One of them is being the rise of the GLP-1s, you know, like your Ozempic and stuff like that, because apparently that's really inhibiting the amount people are drinking. Mm. And the interesting thing is it's the kind of people that used to drink a lot that are not drinking. So it's like your highest value customers, essentially.
Hasn't stopped Scotty.
No, fair enough. I wouldn't know anything about that. I'm teetotal, by the way.
Oh, you are? Okay, well, good.
Not any moral reason. I just don't drink. I'm not against
it. But your point's well made. GLP-1s overall is definitely reducing the consumption for people who used to drink a lot.
And then the governments love a sin tax, as we all know. They love sticking a few more pence out. And it's not just the UK, it's everywhere. You know, Australia, Canada, even the US. But it's more of a state-by-state basis. And then the other thing is younger generations are just changing the way they get their fixes, shall we say. Mm. You know, a 25-year-old today drinks a lot less than a 45-year-old did 20 years ago. And they drink a lot less than a 65-year-old did 40 years ago. And I feel like that trend's going to continue. So, I mean, it's a fairly solid business, and it's probably very cheap around this 14 quid mark. But I won't get too excited by it. I'd wait until it looks like it's beginning to recover. But, I mean, probably the worst things that anyone ever told me when I started my career was that technical analysis was nonsense. And it's not. It's part of a toolkit that you probably ought to think about.
Yeah.
And if you bring that chart up again in a second, you can't imagine a more perfect kind of straight line channel down. There's no point in getting involved in that unless it starts looking like it's going to go the other way.
Yeah. The only thing I can think might happen is that because it's the market cap now is 30 billion. Actually, the enterprise value is well over 50 billion. I mean, I was just going to say, would somebody buy it to break it up? And that is a possibility.
Yeah, they easy could. You could easily see someone like a 3G buying it and ruining it.
Or LVMH.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that one, but that's a good one, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they hold a part, they're a minority, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
Because they own a part of the champagne bit or something. I can't remember exactly how the cross shareholding works, but yeah.
Yeah.
Mind you, their share price is not exactly doing well. I mean,
yeah, I know.
Diageo's kind of gets mixed in with the luxury goods end of things as well, and that whole area has not been brilliant.
Yeah. No, you're right. No, you make a good point. And also, I think the other thing to think about for investors is that it's well known that we've got a wine lake around the world. They don't sell wine, but there's actually now a whiskey lake and you know, cognac lake, because it's just been they've produced so much of the stuff and haven't sold it recently that they're just building up masses and masses of stocks, which is they say is maturing and increasing in value. Well, you've got to sell it, mate, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
is what you talk about. Show us the money story. Okay, good. Let's wrap some of the other questions. We've got Ben Sharman asking a third question. Crikey, he's on a good form today. Rosebank Industries, which is, I think, is a bit of a buy and build engineering company. If I remember rightly, they just spent a lot of money, $3 billion or dollars or something, and raised about $1 billion. Are these the Melrose guys?
That's exactly who they are. They're the Melrose guys. It's not buy and build. It's buy, improve, and sell.
Yeah, okay.
So the same thing that they did with Melrose.
Yeah.
Melrose got a slightly tarnished reputation because the last of their six big acquisitions was GKN, and they only made a bit of money out of it.
Yeah.
Whereas they target doubling your money in 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did for the first five. It's just that GKN lasted a bit longer and didn't make as much money. And I think they learned some lessons from that. And Rosebank is another go at it. They've got three businesses now. One of them is a competitor to Volex. And Volex is going very well. And I think it's in a good position. But it's a management call, and I like the management. I think they're greedy, but I like them. I think they'll make shareholders a lot of money if you just sit with it.
Yeah,
I like Rosebank.
Yeah, I think it's a margin story. We've got to wait until the results come out, see what the net debt to EBITDA is, what their margins, what their potential growth is, and then we'll actually see how it sort of like shakes out. So it may just be slightly early days, unless you've already done that. But clearly the market liked it. I mean, a down market, you know, you look at that sort of like from when they announced the deal, it's jumped from, well, it's jumped to a good 20%, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's I think they're looking at 5 to 7 percentage points of increase in margin.
Yeah.
And then get rid of, you know, as soon as they can, really.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got a final one from Andy. He's asking about, I don't know whether you know anything about it, but Beaks Financial. This is basically a
little bit.
It's a hardware software business that does high speed trading into exchanges and for hedge fund managers and prime brokers to allow them to connect quickly and execute trades, you know, at the lightning speed. Any thoughts?
It's a difficult. I mean, I think a few people know about the masses of equity and incentive that they do with staff, which is sort of the big criticism. I have looked at it a few times, and I wrote it up for Money Week. There's just something about it that just doesn't sit right with me, and I can't put my finger on it. Mm. So I haven't got involved, and I probably won't.
Yeah.
I think I'm afraid it's not the most useful thing, a bit of information, but
yeah. No, I would say, I mean, I've had a look at it, Andy, and I would just be clear about what you're buying. Is it basically a hardware type business where they rent out their equipment into exchanges and then do a revenue share on top, and what type of returns they do, or is it actually a one-to-many software model? Which will generate much better scalable margins going forward. And I think that's where the market is struggling. Is it basically just a straight infrastructure play and therefore will make sort of 12% ROI over the long term? Or is it actually a really fast growing software business? And I think the market hasn't yet made a decision yet. So that'd be my biggest take. Mm-hmm. We got Bruce Packard. He's asking about any quick thoughts on the banks as a sector, because they've had a real rock star performance. The likes of Lloyds, I looked at the weekend, is well over net tangible assets in terms of its pricing, about a quid. But there are fears over the private credit angle, which has hit Barclays a bit, I think. Yeah. And I think they're reporting in the States as well, actually, this week.
Barclays. Oh yeah, they probably are.
Yeah, as in like the banking sector. I know
quite well. He, in case you don't realise, he was a sell side banks analyst for a very long time. So But yes, I think they were very interesting when they were much cheaper. I think they're less interesting where they are now. I don't really know how the private credit thing's going to come out, but they do have much much stronger balance sheets than they had, say, 15 years ago. Mm. So even if there is some nasties. Who was it? Jamie Dimon saying something about
cockroaches.
Cockroaches, that's the one. I don't think it's going to be like systemic like it was in 2008. I think, you know, there'll be a few write-offs here and there probably, and if that happens, there might be some opportunities. But I really liked them when they were all trading at fractions of book value. I'm less interested now they're around where they are.
Yeah, you'd go for Wise, basically, a fast-growing fintech rather than a sort of like a... I'm with you as well. Okay, good. Well, thanks very much, James. We've got a final sort of like question I ask all our experts, out of the ones we've discussed or any others. What's your sort of your favourite stock idea, underlined idea, for the next sort of 12 months?
I'm going to go back to Focusrite. I called it in Money Week at the start of the year, and then the Iran thing happened. It got kicked. But I still think it's on the improving track, and I don't think people are appreciating it.
Yeah, good. And do you own shares in it at all?
I do, yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Well, yeah, it's up to say. It's a nice 5% today, so a good one to leave. All right, then. Well, thanks very much, Jamie. Thanks everyone, for your questions, and best of luck. I look forward to touching base in 6 months' time.
In next week, I'll see you at Mellow.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
See you later, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.